Chapter 7. The Lie. I'm bad at sex. I used to be really bad at sex. Whoa, Nelly. You didn't think I was going there, but I totally am. I'm going to talk about sex as a married Christian woman, and I hope it'll be okay. My husband? He's likely hiding under a rock right now because me writing about this is definitely his worst nightmare. My worst nightmare is getting chased by Bigfoot, so I guess we all have our crosses to bear, Dave. But Dave shouldn't be worried. I'm not writing about him. I'm writing about me and my bad sex. I'm choosing to write about this big, scary, embarrassing thing at the risk of petrifying my in-laws and giving Meemaw a heart attack because I think it's important. I don't think women talk about it enough. Oh, sure, the world talks about it. As much as it can, as loud as it can, as often as it can, but not in a realistic way. Not in a way that makes tangible sense to a virginal clarinet player whose experience with men when she met her husband was equal to her experience with hunting large game in the African wilds. Which is to say, none. None at all. My early opportunities for sexual education included ladies at church, who didn't speak about it within my hearing, or media as a whole, which showed me an ideal that was impossible to achieve. So I walked into my marriage with no realistic idea of what to expect. Which is flipping ridiculous. I wish just one time before I got married, someone had said, "Look, here are my experiences, here's what you need to know, here's what you should consider, and also, the first few times you have sex, you should pee afterwards so you don't get a UTI." Somewhere in Texas, an older reader just fainted. Yes, I wrote about a urinary tract infection. If that freaks you out, move right along to the next chapter, sister, because it's going to get way more intimate than that. I knew very little about sex other than what I had gleaned from TV or movies, so I was terrible at it. And not terrible as in awkward, though I was most definitely that. It was terrible because I was miserable. And I made my husband miserable, too. 5 years into our marriage, our sex life was nearly non-existent. By comparison, we'll celebrate our 14th wedding anniversary this year, and now our sex life is the stuff of legends. No, seriously. We do it more than any married couple you know. Or at least, more often than most married couples with 4 kids and 2 full-time jobs. We have sex not out of obligation, but because it's really, really good. When it's really good, why would you not go at it like a couple of howler monkeys whenever you can? Today, it's awesome. But it was a long road from there to here. And I'm going to tell you all about it in case you find yourself in the same place. And because I don't want you to get a UTI. Listen up. When I met Dave, I was 19 years old, and he was 27. I had never been on a date before, and he didn't know how much younger I was than him. As I've already told you, when the truth came out a couple months in, it went over like an obese cat falling off the back fence. It was an ungraceful and violent fall, but we still landed on our feet. Dave has been my best friend since that first year together. He is my favorite human on the planet, and I love him so much it makes my heart want to explode. When we got married, we had the happiest life I could have possibly dreamed up for myself. And as for sex, we did it like rabbits. We did it like rabbits because that's what you're supposed to do as newlyweds, right? How many times could we do it in a day? How many times in an hour? I would do it in the rain, in the dark, on a train, in a car, in a tree. You get the point, Sam I am. We were having a lot of sex. And I loved it. I loved it because being physically close with him made me feel cherished and adored. I loved it because it made him so happy. It made us so happy. We were newlyweds, we were having sex, and life was good. But as the first couple of years went on and the newness wore off, the joy of the honeymoon phase wore off too. In the beginning, my excitement made me bold. As time went on, though, I felt less comfortable, as if a switch had been flipped. I was raised to be this good Christian girl. Now I was supposed to be a sex kitten, but I had no idea how. So I drank. We'd go on a date and I'd have just enough wine to feel sexy. Then I'd try and do sexy things or act in a sexy way, but I rarely enjoyed it as much as he did. Did I pretend to enjoy it? Heck yes. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Then I started to resent the fact that I wasn't enjoying it. Resented that I thought I should have sex even when I wasn't excited about it. Then I had a baby. And my body morphed, and my stomach stretched out, and my boobs leaked, and I was exhausted. Sex was basically the least enjoyable thing I could imagine. But I kept doing it. Kept pretending that I loved every second. I never once talked to Dave about how I was feeling. I was too embarrassed and unsure. I was also nervous about hurting his feelings, so I kept it to myself. More time passed, and our sex life was hanging on by a thread. By the time our second son was a toddler, sex barely happened at all. And when I came out of the fog of being a mother of two and thought enough to ask Dave about it, the answer was hard to hear. "Why don't we have sex anymore?" I asked him one night. He looked at me as though the question hurt his feelings. I got tired of being shot down. I was immediately defensive. "I don't shoot you down. I always say yes." "You might agree, Rachel, but you don't actually want to. And that's worse than not having it at all." Initially, I was pretty annoyed. Here I was taking one for the team, and he was hurt because I wasn't more enthusiastic. But the more I thought about it, the more I understood how right he was. I might have been agreeing to sex, but I was stiff and uncomfortable, tired and unenthusiastic. Agreeing to it did not mean I was embracing it. My husband could tell I wasn't enjoying it, so rather than asking me to participate halfway, he had just stopped asking altogether. What a bummer. They say the first step to fixing something is admitting you have a problem. Now, I know many of you are super in touch with your own feminine mystique. You've got the whole sex thing down pat, and you have 100 orgasms a week. Good for you, sister. Seriously, you're my hero. And the following advice probably isn't for you. For you, what I have to say will sound trite and basic or maybe even naive. That's cool, because these are the things that worked for me, and I share them in case they are helpful to someone who is like me or who I used to be. Here are the steps I took to go from being bad at sex to being exceptional at sex. There are 7 of them, one for every day of the week. Things that helped me. Number 1. I redefined sex in my own mind. For the longest time, sex symbolized a lot of things, and not all of them were positive. I decided to change what I thought sex was. This might not be what sex is for you, your friends, or the Holy Ghost and all the saints, but going forward, I decided that sex was supposed to be a fun experience that would always be more compelling than whatever else I could be doing. Up until that point, I was continuously weighing sex against other things, reading a book, watching TV, etc. And it was playing second fiddle. But if I reminded myself that sex was always an awesome opportunity, then I would presumably want to choose it. Number 2, I figured out how sex could be an earth-shattering experience. When you're uncomfortable or don't feel sexy or are nervous or shy or whatever, you're not going to enjoy yourself. If you're not enjoying yourself, you're not having good sex. So I asked myself, how can I enjoy this more? What's holding me back? The answer? Me. Next, I spoke with Dave about all the things I was thinking and feeling. It shocked me that after all our years together, I could still be so embarrassed, but I pushed through it. We needed to be on the same page, and the only way to get there was by opening up the book and talking to him about it. Number 3. I read Hebrews 13:4. Part of my hang-ups were related to my being a good Christian girl who couldn't reconcile becoming a freak in the sheets. And then I read Hebrews 13:4. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the bed be undefiled. Now, straight up, I'm sure I'm not reading this right. I'm sure someone who studied theology will tell me that this actually means something different. But what I read, or what I take away when I read that line, is that the things that happen in my bed with my husband cannot be weird or bad or wrong. Let me back up and say there are definitely things that a committed, monogamous couple can do sexually that can be incredibly hurtful to them both. Pornography, for example, is extremely damaging to both the consumer and the people being used as objects for your lust. But the other stuff? Lingerie, leather, toys, role play, trying every position possible, going at it on the kitchen table, dirty talk, whatever. If it turns you on and doesn't hurt you, I say go for it. Number four, I embrace my body. Having a low opinion of your body is so damaging to your ability to enjoy sex. I used to worry about whether or not my tummy was tight or if my butt looked okay in those panties. You know what Dave was thinking when I took off my clothes? Boobies! Your partner is just thrilled you showed up, and all those things you're questioning aren't helping anyone. I practiced positive self-talk about how great my butt looked or how sexy I was. I did it so much that at some point, I started to believe it. Number five, I committed to my orgasm. Okay, just writing that line makes me blush. I'm imagining some future book signing where a reader comes up to my table and says, "So, you committed to your orgasm." But this is important, and even if it embarrasses me, I want you to know it. Back in the day when we first started having sex, an orgasm for me was like icing on the cake. But here's the thing, ladies. Orgasms are not icing on the cake. Orgasms are the cake. A second orgasm is icing on the cake. Remember how I said that I had to figure out how to make sex the greatest thing ever? Remember how I told you that I wanted to desire it over anything else in my life? You know how you do that? With orgasms. I decided years ago that I would never, and I mean never, again have sex that didn't include an orgasm for me. When I told Dave this plan, he agreed it was the greatest idea I'd ever come up with. Because here's the thing, for most of us, our partners are thrilled to give us pleasure. And if we're both committed to my orgasm at the outset, it will happen. Number six, I had to figure out what turns me on. Oh, sure, I'd been turned on many times in my life, but I'd never truly considered the difference between what really did it for me and what was just situational. Knowing what turns me on was key because remember, my orgasms were our new endgame, and I don't know how to have one without being turned on. So we experimented until I learned myself and my body better. Feel free to head back up to the undefiled marriage bed paragraph for a list of ideas. Number seven, we committed to having sex every day for a month. Years ago, at the outset of changing up our sex lives, Dave and I initiated something we called Sexy September. We vowed to have sex every day during the month of September. No excuses. It was pretty daunting in the beginning, especially with full-time jobs and two little kids, but the end result was fantastic. It gave me the opportunity to experiment and to try things out without any pressure. Also, shockingly, having more sex made us want to have more sex. I highly encourage you to pick your own sexy month and go for it. Chapter 8, The Lie. I don't know how to be a mom. I am the worst pregnant woman you've ever met in your life. No, really. I hate basically every part of pregnancy except the baby you get at the end. I have friends who love it. Like, capital L-O-V-E, wish they could carry 100 babies and be pregnant forever. I fully support their Earth Mother calling and the obvious joy they find in being a vessel for human life. But I don't share it. I am thankful for my pregnancies. So stinking thankful to the bottom of my heart that God blessed me with the ability to carry three beautiful little boys to term. I do not take this for granted when I know so many women who pray for the same blessing have not received it. But every single part of pregnancy is hard on me. The morning sickness never once went away with the morning, nor did it end after the first trimester. I put on pregnancy weight like it was my part-time job, then felt incapable of taking it off. My back hurt. My feet hurt, and during my first pregnancy, I got a varicose vein in the most terrible place a human being can get a varicose vein, which meant I had to wear special weight-bearing underwear with each consecutive pregnancy. Side note, If you were ever curious about the easiest way to crush a gal's spirit, I'd recommend searching groin support panties on the internet. But I digress. The point is, I'm pretty bad at pregnancy. On top of everything else I've mentioned, I also dealt with unrelenting fear. What if I ate bologna and contracted listeria? What if my blueberry-sized fetus developed some rare disease since the last time I'd had an ultrasound? What if all the Carl's Jr. chicken strips I was eating gave him high cholesterol? What if the cord wrapped around his neck? What if the room wasn't ventilated enough when I painted the nursery? What if the placenta previa hadn't cleared up? What if that vodka Red Bull I drank when I was 2 weeks pregnant but didn't yet know it had hurt him? Seriously, though, what if the cord wrapped around his neck? The worries were overbearing, and I managed them with the dignity of a geriatric terrier. Which is to say, I barked at anyone who got too close, and I needed a special step stool to hoist myself in and out of bed. When the blessed event finally occurred, I was ecstatic. Firstly, because I was finally going to meet Jackson Cage, a child we had dreamed up and named on a cross-country road trip years before. Also, I was finally going to have my body back to myself. I was euphoric to have made it through the labor, something I honestly believed would be the toughest part of motherhood. But at home, with Jackson in all his perfect glory, I was unprepared for how inadequate I'd feel as a new mom. I loved him obsessively. I was also terrified of him. All the fears I had while he was inside of me suddenly multiplied by 100 million. I barely slept at night because I was positive he'd stop breathing if I wasn't there to watch him do it. Breastfeeding was hard and painful, and I never produced enough milk to feed the giant offspring Dave and I created. We had to supplement with formula. We had to learn how to manage his reflux. We had to navigate a middle-of-the-night ER visit when he got a high fever at 7 weeks old, all while dealing with the soul-sucking loss of sleep. My husband has always been my best friend and my favorite human on earth, but I remember once, when Jackson was about a month and a half old, looking at Dave and sincerely believing I hated him. Like, to the pit of my soul, hated him. I like to tell young married couples about the time I hated Dave. I like to tell them because I want them to know how this feeling is totally normal and they'll likely find themselves there now and again. Jackson was 6 weeks old, which, by the way, friends, is the most probable week for real unadulterated hatred, and he was still waking up in the night. It's important to emphasize the word still here because I think my young, ignorant, pre-child self thought we'd be back to neutral and coasting toward parental bliss by the end of month one. Bless my precious childlike heart. Becoming new parents is such a fake out. The first 2 weeks, you're deep in euphoria, and yes, it's hard, but people are bringing you casseroles, and your mama is still in town to help, and you have this perfect little cherub whom you love so much you want to bite the chubby cheeks right off his face. And then the next couple of weeks go by, and you settle into a zombie routine. Your boobs start to leak through your clothes, and you haven't bathed in a week. Also, your hair is literally the most terrible it's ever been. But whatever, you're getting through it. But by 6 weeks, the wheels start to fall off. You're thinking, why am I so exhausted? Why do I still look like I'm 5 months pregnant? Why am I still spending all my time nursing? And what punk invented cluster feeding because I will punch him right in his stupid face? At 6 weeks, I was a little, frustrated with how much I was doing to care for our baby. In other words, I didn't feel like Dave was being that helpful, and the responsibility of managing most of it by myself was overwhelming. I didn't mention any of this to him, though. I just bottled it up nice and tight and shoved it down deep where it could never bother anybody. Everyone knows that's the best way to handle your problems, right? Then one day we were chatting about something, and Chernobyl fell out of his mouth. I'm tired. That's what he said. Those were the words. My world shifted on its axis, and my eyes widened to 8 times their natural size. But he didn't notice. He was too busy talking. I'm just so exhausted from waking up early this morning. Blah, blah, blah. More ill-conceived words. You know that TV show Snapped? It's a docu-style series about real-life crimes where women just snap and take down someone on the way. That was me. I went full on Sybil. I was crying. I was laughing. I was trying to figure out who would raise this baby if I strangled Dave with the plastic tubing from my breast pump. To quote one of the most famous sayings in our entire marriage, I shout cried, "On my wedding day, I never thought I could hate you as much as I hate you right now." It was not one of my best moments. But luckily for me, Dave, and all the other humans on this planet, relationships are full of opportunities for grace. Even when the baby started sleeping, and we started sleeping, I was a mess. I love Jackson, but I didn't really feel bonded to him. I was so terrified of doing something wrong that I never let myself relax. I was so focused on housework and chores and making sure his onesie stayed spotless that I never just enjoyed my time as a new mom. I think because I was so worried about failing him, I ended up failing myself. Because I was so concerned with how we should all look as a family, I didn't take the time to let myself feel connected. I continued this pattern with my second son, Sawyer, so that when I became a mother of two, I had a serious case of postpartum depression. I spent almost every day imagining what it would be like to run away from home. I sat in our living room, breastfeeding my week-old baby, while a 20-month-old ran around the room littered with toys and dirty diapers I hadn't yet thrown away, and I'd think, I should just drive away and never look back. Everyone here would be better off without me. Because I didn't feel like I was succeeding at being a mom, the one thing I should innately know how to do, I was positive I was a failure. In retrospect, I can recognize that my perception of this role was based on images I saw online and in magazines, but at the time, I was too sleep-deprived to know I was chasing an impossibility. I had spent so much time worrying about not living up to some Pinterest-worthy standard that I completely lost who I actually was. Oh, those were dark days. When I look at pictures of that time, my hair might be combed and I might even be wearing some lipstick, but my eyes look haunted. So this chapter is for the new mamas or the soon-to-be mamas. Listen up. You don't have to have it all figured out. You don't have to know everything. The mechanics of keeping a newborn alive are fairly simple. Feed it, cuddle it, love it, change it when it's wet, keep it warm, cuddle it again. A new mother's daily list of goals should boil down to 1, take care of the baby. 2, take care of yourself. Boom, the end. Darn it, you didn't get to the laundry today? Look at your list again. Did you take care of the baby? Yes? Did you take care of yourself? Also yes? Oh, I think you're crushing this new mom business then. I guess the laundry can wait. What's that? You're sad because you haven't lost the baby weight? Check out your handy-dandy to-do list with exactly 2 items on it. Is the baby still alive? Awesome. How about you? Are you still breathing in and out? Well then, it looks like you're the greatest mom ever. Keep on trucking. Pinterest is awesome, and decorating your nursery in perfectly coordinating colors is half the fun of conceiving a child. Looking at Instagram? Heck, I still look at all those pregnant Instagrammers for adorable, bump-appropriate wardrobe tips, and I'm not even pregnant. It makes sense to look outside yourselves when you're unsure about something new, and we are rarely as uncertain as we are during new motherhood. But let me tell you this, because I didn't understand it until years later. The God who made the moon and the stars and the mountains and the oceans, the Creator who did all of those things, believed that you and your baby were meant to be a pair. That doesn't mean you're going to be a perfect fit. That doesn't mean you won't make mistakes. It does mean that you need not fear failure because you can't fail a job you were created to do. Somewhere, some cynical reader is thinking about all the parents who do fail. There are plenty of mamas who make bad choices, who hurt themselves or their children. As a former foster parent, I know firsthand that there are babies suffering right now from abuse and neglect, and even if a divine plan brought them to their mamas, it might not be the best answer for them to stay there. But I'm not speaking about those mamas. I'm talking to you. Don't be overwhelmed with anxiety that your baby should be on a sleep schedule, eating organic foods, or sitting up by now. I'm talking to the person who is reading all of the books and all of the articles and feels overwhelmed by what's right when there are so many possible wrongs. The very fact that you are so concerned, sweet friend, means you're engaged and focused and dedicated to doing what's best. That makes you the best kind of parent. The rest will take care of itself. Things that helped me. Number one, finding a tribe. Join a church group, go to Mommy and Me yoga, or look online for a club to join. Look for a group of women who understand what it means to be a new mom too. There's so much power in solidarity. There's so much grace when you're talking with someone who also has baby puke on her shirt. Number two, staying away from Pinterest. For the love of all that is holy, nobody should be allowed on Pinterest after a big life event. Why? Because you feel like you're missing out, or that your life, nursery, or post-baby body should look like what you're finding on the internet. Pay attention to what is giving you anxiety or making you question yourself. If it's social media, then do your heart a favor and take a break from it. I promise it will still be there when you're getting more sleep and feeling less emotional. Number three, getting out of the house every single day. The best thing you can do for yourself, your sanity, and your baby is to leave the scene of the crime. Leave the place with the dishes in the sink and the overflowing diaper genie. Put your baby in a carrier or a stroller and go on a walk around the neighborhood. Put on some headphones and listen to Beyonce or Adele or a podcast on business ethics. Do whatever you have to do to remind yourself that there is a life beyond your nest and that you are still part of it. Number four, talking to someone about my feelings. An effective way for us to overcome lies is to speak them aloud to a partner. Whether you choose your spouse, your friend, or a trusted family member, sharing with them that you're struggling can give you the support you need to see all of the falsities that are popping up in your life. Chapter 9. The Lie? I'm Not a Good Mom. If we're going to talk about how much I struggled as a new mom, then we also have to talk about how much I have struggled as a mom in general. Navigating what it means to be a mother while dealing with a newborn baby is brutal. But what comes next? That's an emotional mind screw of epic proportions. When my oldest was 7, he crushed my soul over Cheerios. "You know what you need, Mommy?" he asked me one morning while I was pouring cereal into a bowl shaped like a bulldog's face. When a child gives you an opener like that, the conversation could go in any direction imaginable. Maybe I needed a superhero cape, or a new spatula, or pink hair. His train of thought could go anywhere. "What?" I wanted to know. "What do I need?" "You need one of those necklaces with our initials on them. You know, the ones with the letters for each kid's name." At the time, monogram charm necklaces were all the rage. "Yes, I know those necklaces." "You should get one of those. All the moms at my school have them," he told me between bites. "You need to get one too." "Okay." I was a bit confused. "Why do I need to get one?" He smiled at me happily. "So you can finally be like all the other moms." Finally. Like all the other moms. A handful of words shouldn't crush you, shouldn't make you question yourself as a mother. But when you're already questioning yourself, and then someone, not just your son, but anyone, brings up the exact thing you've been worried about, it doesn't really take much to push you over the edge. I hadn't worried about what my jewelry, or lack thereof, said about me as a mom, but I was glaringly aware of how different I was from other mothers at Jackson's school events. I just didn't know that he'd noticed as well. I grappled with his statement for days. His suggestion to be like all the other moms meant that he recognized I wasn't like them already. It meant that he saw me as different, and when you're little, all you really want is to be just like everybody else. What he noticed is that I'm not like the other moms because I work a lot. I very rarely get to drop him off at school or pick him up. Because of that, I made a special effort to volunteer in his classroom every other week. But that wasn't right either, because even though I sat in the teeny tiny chair cutting papers and stuffing homework folders like the other volunteers, I wasn't in jeans or yoga pants. I was in high heels and a white blazer that I should have known better than to wear on a day they were making teepees out of brown modeling clay. Another mom was sure to point that out to me. I was wearing that outfit because directly following that session at school, I was heading to a meeting. Like most working moms, my life is a constant juggling act. Sometimes it looks like a perfectly orchestrated ballet, where I'm able to flip back and forth between the kids' activities and work activities. Other times it looks like a triage unit, where I'm doing everything I can to keep up with the need around me and yet still dropping the ball on priorities that feel like they're slipping away before I can get to them. At the time, I hoped that committing to extra projects for my boys would make up the difference. So I'd overwhelm an already overwrought schedule by agreeing to plan the big fundraiser for their class, or being on the board at preschool, or taking off an afternoon to cover soccer practice. I thought the extra effort would win me brownie points with my boys, but it didn't. My children were little, and their memory stretched only as far as yesterday. Even now, they don't care about today's business trip, my looming book deadline, or the staff at my office who count on me to pull my weight. My kids care that their friend's mom went on the museum field trip yesterday, and I didn't because I was flying to Chicago for work. Having kids in school feels stressful to me. My three little people have totally different schedules to keep track of, and my baby girl has her own agenda. There's paperwork, both the kind that accumulates in massive piles in the first couple of weeks, and the loose-leaf permission slips and sign-up forms that I find shoved into backpacks throughout the year. Also, school lunches. I am pretty regimented about using a system to keep their lunches organized. But now that the boys are older, they want to have lunch at school, but only on specific days. So now tracking the cafeteria calendar is a part-time job, as is making their lunch cards have enough money on them to get the teriyaki chicken this Thursday. There are field trips and performances. There are bake sales and carnivals. There are drop-offs and pickups and banking days when they get out an hour early, and if Jackson, God bless him, didn't remind me about them, I'd likely forget every single one. There are so many things to remember, and I guess what ultimately stresses me out is the idea that other moms, at school or out there in the wild world, are somehow way better at keeping track of this than I am. I am one of the most organized people I have ever met, and even with all of my planning, I still am constantly forgetting things, or remembering them at midnight the night before they're due. And no matter what I do or create or volunteer for, some mythical other mom at school has done it better. Yes, Mommy, you can buy the t-shirt we need for Make Your Own T-Shirt Day, but Liam's mom grew organic cotton plants. Then she hand-separated the seed from the fiber before spinning it into thread and fabric for the shirt she sewed him herself. I can't even begin to keep up, and the stress of trying to do so can make me crazy. So this year, I made a big decision. I'm over it. I am utterly over the idea of crushing back-to-school time, or any other part of school for that matter. I do some parts of it well. Our morning routine might be choreographed chaos, but we are never late to school. My kids, with the exception of the 4-year-old, are well-groomed and well-mannered, and they get good grades. Beyond that, they are good people, the kind of kids who befriend the outcasts and the loners. Sure, they attack each other at home and are dramatic enough about their lack of access to technology to earn themselves Oscars. But whatever. We are doing pretty good. And pretty good is way better than trying to fake perfection any day of the week. So, I might not volunteer in the classroom this year. Though, count me in for store-bought goodies at the class party. And I might not make it to every field trip. Because even if it means I'm the jerk of all jerks, I hate chaperoning field trips. Also, gird your loins. A babysitter will likely pick my boys up from school more than I will. I wish our town would extend grace for this. Perhaps the same level of grace extended to working fathers who aren't able to make pickup either. Mom, you should parent in whatever way works for your family and spend less time worrying about other people's perception of how you're doing. Can we stop being so hard on ourselves and instead focus on the good work we are doing, the results of which are evident in the awesome little people we're raising? What if we all went into the next school year with the simple intention of just gracefully doing our best? Meaning, let's try our darndest to turn in every slip on time and remember every Wacky Hair Wednesday, all the while knowing that we'll inevitably forget something, be too busy to volunteer, or fail to compete with Liam's mom and her non-GMO custom gingerbread kits for every member of the class. Can we agree that imperfection is okay? Liam's mom is awesome at her thing. But you and me, we're awesome at ours. We can walk into the school year and remember that we're raising our children into the adults they will become. Our valiant endeavor will take us a lifetime of effort. A single day, or even a handful of days, when you aren't mom of the century, won't make or break your kids. It's the intention to do well that will see them through. It's the lessons in grace and self-care and realistic expectations where you teach them about what you're capable of that will truly serve them later on. Choose a handful of things that you rock as a school mom, then knock those out of the park as often as you can. The other stuff? Give yourself permission to do the best you can and the grace to be peaceful on the days when you miss the mark. My children's attitudes will shift and grow over time. I believe that the very thing that makes me so different now, the company I run, is one of the things that will make me cool when they're older. I hope I'm creating something they'll be proud of. I hope I'm showing them the power of following their dreams and the value of entrepreneurship. I hope so many things for the future, but often those don't help me with today. Today, I'm on yet another business trip. My third in as many weeks. Today, Jackson is nervous about rehearsing his lines to audition for the class musical, and it's hard to accept because I'm good at musical theater, but not there to help him. Today, Ford has a cough and a fever, and he's been clingy and fighting us on bedtime. But I won't be there to help Dave manage him this evening around 8 o'clock when he decides he's meant to stay up all night like a club promoter from the 80s. There's always something. Something that can overwhelm me and make me question whether or not I'm doing any of this correctly. That anxiety I felt when they were first born didn't exactly go away. It manifested and grew like a yeast starter. The only difference between now and then is that I'm better able to see that narrative for the lie that it is. Being a perfect mom is a myth, but being a pretty great mom most of the time is actually possible. I don't believe in one best way to parent. In fact, I think it could be pretty damaging to our children if we try to impose the ideals of someone else onto how our family should function. The Hollis boys are sarcastic. They get that from their parents. Dave and I think it's hilarious, and we admire their quick wit. But in your house, their sarcasm might be seen as disrespectful. Likewise, I am incredibly strict with manners. I want yes ma'ams and no sirs. I demand pleases and thank yous. And if someone says something inappropriate or rude at my dinner table, they will be asked to leave. But maybe in your house that seems over the top. Maybe at your table you burp the alphabet after every meal and then laugh like maniacs together. If so, awesome. Mama, there is no one way to be a mother. There's also no one way to be a family. Remember when I was talking to the new moms about the daily requirements? Keep the baby alive and keep yourself alive as well? Well, the list for older children might be extended, but the intention is still the same. You need to care, truly care, that you are raising your babies to grow up to be good people. You need to do the work today to ensure that it happens. On some days, you will knock it out of the ballpark. And on other days, you will scream the house down, wondering who replaced your children with changelings who have horrible manners and no respect. Good news. Tomorrow is a new day. Tomorrow, you'll count to 10 before you lose your temper. And maybe they'll eat every bite of the dinner you made and say something so hilarious you'll think, man, people without kids are totally missing out. You will experience every kind of day as a mama. And you will need to accept the grab bag of good, bad, ugly, awesome, magical, and miserable days as a parent. You don't have to get it right all the time. You don't have to do things like anybody else's mom. You only have to care. Not only about them, but also about yourself. You cannot properly take care of your children or teach them how to be whole and happy people if you are miserable and harsh with yourself. That means doing the absolute best with them that you can. That means calling in reinforcements in the form of friends, your spouse, your mama, or the playland at your local gym when you're fraying at the edges and need a break. That means giving yourself time alone and away from the precious cherubs who are driving you crazy. Get a manicure, go for a run, call up your college roommate for dinner. Better yet, plan a whole weekend if you can. Imagine 2 full days without once wiping anyone's nose. Imagine being called by your actual first name. Can you imagine sleeping in? Oh my gosh, girl, you are going to sleep so hard. Or maybe you'll get a massage. Or maybe you'll hole up somewhere all day watching Drew Barrymore movies on TBS. The world is your oyster. Then imagine coming home feeling uplifted and renewed, feeling better able to manage the squeals and screams and requests to have the crust cut off without wanting to lock yourself in the closet. Imagine living your motherhood out from now until forever without guilt. Imagine caring for your children and yourself simultaneously without constantly questioning every decision you make. It's possible. It's also a choice. You have to choose not to compare. Don't compare your family to other families or yourself to other women or moms at school. You have to choose not to compare your children either. Not to your friends' kids and most definitely not to each other. I am not saying that you shouldn't strive to improve yourself as a parent. And when it comes to your kids, your job is to help them become their best selves. But sister, please, please, please stop allowing your fear of getting it wrong to color every beautiful thing you're doing right. Years ago, I had to make a choice. Either I had to embrace being a working mom and be wholly proud of what I was doing, or I had to quit and commit to being a stay-at-home mom. Constantly castigating myself for my choices wasn't fair to my children, and it definitely wasn't fair to me. I also wasn't setting a great example for them. Did I really want them to see me spending my life pursuing a dream while also anxiously acting as though I didn't deserve the right? Absolutely not. A couple of years ago, when I was trying to lose the baby weight after my second son, I went to visit my trainer. She was a battle axe of a woman with a fondness for burpees, clearly in league with the devil. And more than once, I puked after I spent time with her. Jerk. One day, we were talking about my diet. At the time, I was still going through a bad breakup with Carl's Jr. And she asked me, would you ever feed your child the food you feed yourself? At the time, I had a habit of going half a day without eating, then binging on anything and everything in sight. I was horrified by the question because I put so much time and energy into what my boys ate. No, of course I wouldn't ever feed my children the way I feed myself. Later, a version of this question became the lifeline I used to pull myself back from the brink of debilitating mom guilt. Would I ever want my children to feel this way? Would I ever want them to pursue the desire of their heart, the profession that lights their soul on fire, be it a stay-at-home parent or a cosmonaut or an entrepreneur, but then constantly second-guess every choice they made because it doesn't look like anyone else's social media feed? Oh my gosh, you guys, the very idea makes my heart want to stop. I would never want them to struggle with their worth as I have. I would never want them to question themselves to the point of anxiety. I would never want them to think their entire parenting career could be summarily dismissed over Cheerios on a random school morning. So I made a decision. I will do my best. And I will trust that my best is exactly what God intended for these babies. So I choose my battles. I do the best I can with the time I have, and I bend and stretch for the stuff that seems particularly important, even if it only makes sense in the mind of a 7-year-old. One season, Sawyer announced that he only liked my sandwiches for lunch, not Daddy's. I started getting up early each day to make sure I was the only one who ever made their lunch. When Jackson told me he wanted to start running with me, I bought him shoes and went on the slowest mile-long jog the world has ever known. And when he told me I should get a necklace like the other moms, I got one. I got that necklace, but there are still 100 reasons why I don't fit into all of this as neatly as other women do. For example, I hate organized sports. Being a sports mom is sort of a badge of honor, right? Your kids get into soccer or baseball or hockey or gymnastics or whatever, and you jump right in along with them. All over Facebook and social media are pictures of mamas joyfully cheering from the sidelines. My girlfriend Kate recently told me she nearly lost her voice cheering at her son's game because she was so excited to be there. I love Kate for that. She is so quintessentially that sports mom who's in for every single part of it. But I am not. I love my kids more than anything on this planet. But sports? Meh. Sports aren't really my thing. For several years, I beat myself up because I dreaded having our Saturdays disrupted by a game schedule. I felt like a crappy mom because I should want to be out there watching my son play soccer or baseball, but I really didn't. Oh, sure. On the outside, I cheered and yelled and made the special game day snacks. But on the inside, and I know I will get flack for this admission, I thought, and still think, it's kind of boring. My husband, he could not be more thrilled to be there. He loves sports of any kind, and I suspect watching his sons play them might be on his list of top 3 favorite things on this planet. But I don't get it. I mean, I'm happy the boys are happy. I'm thrilled that they're involved in a team sport, learning the benefits of physical activity and gaining confidence in themselves. Beyond that, it's just not my favorite thing. And I know there are those of you who don't understand this perspective. For you, these kind of activities make your heart sing. For you, these kind of moments are exactly what you imagine when you dreamed of being a mom. And I think it's so rad that you feel that way. It's awesome that we each get to experience moments of blissed out mama pride with our babies, but what evokes that is different for every one of us. If time has taught me anything, it's that our differences are what make this life unique. None of us are exactly like the other, and this is a good thing because there's no right way to be. The room mom, the working mother, the woman without children, the retired grandma, the mom who co-sleeps, the mama who bottle-fed her baby, the strict mom, the hipster mom, the one who lets her kids go shoeless, or the one who enrolls her baby in music enrichment classes at birth. Whoever, whatever you are, you're adding spice and texture and nuance into this big, beautiful soup of modern-day parenting. I can look at other mamas and learn from them. I can also leave the things that don't strike me as authentic or practical for our family. You can do the same for your own. That is the beauty of growing and learning and figuring out exactly who you are. Things that helped me. Number one, I looked at the evidence. I used to spend so much time obsessing over all the things I was doing wrong as a mom. But you know what? My kids are awesome. Oh, sure, they drive me bonkers at times, but they get great grades and are kind and welcoming to everyone they meet. I'm the one they come to when they're hurt. I'm the one they call out for in the night if they have a bad dream. Our bond is strong and unbreakable, which doesn't change simply because I'm a working mother. Look at the evidence in your own life. If you're raising arsonists who are rude to their grandma, well, maybe you need to seek out some help. But if your kids are basically good most of the time, then cut yourself some slack. Number two, I made friends with the other moms. Yes, the ones your kids are comparing you to. Yes, the ones you're comparing yourself to. If they're at all human, then chances are they can tell you that they're also worried about screwing up their kids. Yes, Samantha's mom, who sewed 100 sequins onto 100 buttons onto the hat she made by hand, all to celebrate the 100th day of school. Yep, she's worried about her parenting too. The emperor has no clothes, y'all. And unless you seek out the truth, you're never going to know it. Number three, I focused on quality. When I'm stressing about parenting, it's usually because I feel like I'm lacking for quality time with my kids. Quality time means I'm not on the phone or near a computer or talking to another adult. Usually it looks like reading, playing Candyland, going on movie dates, or cooking with them. When I focus my energy on them, that's when I really feel content that I'm doing a good job. Chapter 10. The Lie? I should be further along by now. Last week, I sat around with a group of women enjoying a glass of wine and a chat. The women around me were all ages, came from different cities, and had various backgrounds. Some had families, some didn't, but all of them were what I would describe as successful. The topic of age came up and whether or not we'd like to celebrate our birthdays and the passing of another year. The general consensus was definitely not. This threw me for a loop. I'm one of those people who loves their own birthday. I plan it months in advance and make long lists of things I want to do, wear sweatpants all day, or what I want to eat, spinach artichoke dip with funfetti cake for dessert. I look forward to it with the same childlike glee I did as a third grader. It's not just the actual celebration I like either. I wear each passing year with pride, and I truly don't care what age I am one way or the other. I know that women don't like growing older. That cliche has been around for as long as we've recorded history, I'm sure. But I had never really asked anyone why they felt that way. So I asked this group of ladies. I wanted to know what they dislike so much about growing older. The answer, at its core, was the same for every single person. I expected some reference to looking older or even feeling older physically. I'd always assumed it had to do with lost youth, and maybe for certain people that's true. But this group's issue with passing time wasn't about what was happening. They disliked growing older because of what wasn't happening. You see, they'd all made plans. As little girls or adolescents or women in their early 20s, they'd made all sorts of them. Little plans and big plans and grandiose shoot-for-the-moon plans that they assumed would have been accomplished long before now. And while they had checked many things off their list, there were still those nagging few, the hanging chads of wishes and dreams that still hadn't come to fruition. So for them, birthdays served as a reminder of all the things they hadn't achieved. For some, they fell short of a career or financial goal. Others wanted to be married or having children. They had set themselves on some sort of course long ago, and each year they didn't reach that preconceived destination was a harsh reminder of the promises they were breaking to themselves. Who hasn't fallen for this lie? I can't count the number of times in my life when I've beaten myself up because I thought my goals had expiration dates. As a side note, what a downer attitude about a day that is supposed to be filled with buttercream icing. But ladies, we need to recognize that this mentality doesn't do any of us any good. We're focusing all of our attention on the absence of something. Imagine a little baby taking her first step. She's joyful and chubby, and she's been balancing in place without holding onto the coffee table for weeks now. Finally, she takes her first cultish stumble from the relative safety of the side table, then wobbles across the perils of the living room rug to grasp the edge of the sofa. She gets there and looks up at you with elation and pride and so much excitement. Now imagine you give her a quick, brittle smile and demand, "Yes, Chloe, that's fine, but why aren't you running by now?" Can you imagine the dismay that baby girl would feel? What kind of parent has that kind of reaction to a child who's just learning to do something new? It would be unheard of for a mother to react so harshly, to judge a baby on what she hasn't yet had the time or life experience to figure out. And yet we do it to ourselves all the time. Our own negative self-talk can be more damaging than the emotional abuse heaped on us by a hateful parent. It's also far more insidious because there's nobody there to stop it, since we rarely even realize it's happening. Beating ourselves up about all the things we think we're doing wrong becomes a litany of white noise. Eventually, we don't even hear it anymore. And for what? Because you thought you'd be partner at your firm by 40? Because you can't believe how much weight you've gained since having kids? Because your sister is already married and you're not even dating anyone? Because you dropped out of college and didn't get your degree? And you're thinking with every passing hour and day and week that it's too late? I call bullcrap. God has perfect timing. If you aren't of a similar faith, think of it as everything happening exactly when it's supposed to. You look at your life and the 8 things you thought you'd have accomplished by 35 and feel depressed. But maybe it's just that you don't have enough life experience yet. You're like that baby who's balancing in the middle of the room on chubby baby thighs. Maybe you have to get your bearings for a while longer. Or maybe the goal wasn't ever meant to be yours. Maybe you are destined for something so much cooler, which won't come until 5 years down the road. Maybe you have to walk through the space you're in to be ready for that. Nothing is wasted. Every single moment is preparing you for the next. But whether or not you choose to see this time as something wonderful, the time when God is stretching you and growing you, or maybe forging you in fires hotter than you think you can withstand, all of it is growing you for the person you're becoming, for the future you can't even imagine. When I decided to get pregnant for the first time, I thought I'd snap my fingers and be expecting the next minute. It took 8 months to conceive. 8 months of hoping, 8 months of crying every time I got my period, 8 months of trying not to be jealous of the women around me who were pregnant, 8 months of being sad when it didn't happen the way I thought it should. The morning I finally took a test that showed me 2 pink lines, I ran over to the mirror to look at my face. I kept thinking, I never want to forget how I looked when I found out I would be a mother. I can still see myself in that mirror, wide-eyed and filled with shock and wonder. Jackson Cage Hollis was born on January 30th, 2007, and he is one of the greatest joys in my life. He loves computer games and cooking with me and wears a stack of rainbow-colored rubber bracelets on his right wrist at all times because they're cool, Mom, that's why. Guys, if I had gotten pregnant at any point during those 8 months of trying, I wouldn't have had Jackson. God has perfect timing. I used to dream of being the biggest event planner in Los Angeles. I wanted a big staff and a fancy office and the highest paying clients in town. Year after year, I kept thinking, this is the year I'll need a staff of 20. This is the year I'll produce the governor's ball. This is the year I'll bring home $1 million. I'm a dreamer, you'll recall. And every year we grew, but not as big as I hoped, and I'd feel so depressed that I wasn't as successful as I wanted to be. Then, my little blog, which was only ever supposed to be a marketing tool for the events company, started to grow a fan base. And I absolutely loved testing out recipes for them or talking about how to decorate a living room. Eventually, the site became my full-time business, and a college dropout without any knowledge of tech or digital media found herself running a lifestyle media company with fans in the millions. Beyond that, this work is so much more fun and gratifying than the events ever were. If I'd had the biggest events company in LA with a staff and the millions, I wouldn't have had the time to write the little blog that would eventually become my career and change the trajectory of my life completely. God has perfect timing. Dave and I walked through a long adoption journey. Nearly 5 years ago, we started the process to adopt a little girl from Ethiopia. After mountains of paperwork and nearly a year of filing and preparing and getting fingerprints done for the 100th time, we were officially vetted and waiting for a match. 2 years of waiting later, the adoption program in Ethiopia imploded, and we found out that the continuing wait for a match was futile. We had to mourn the loss of the life and the daughter we had imagined for ourselves. We started over. We decided to adopt through foster care in LA County because we recognized that the need was great. During that journey, we took in two little girls through foster care, and I sobbed for weeks after they had to leave us. 2 months later, we got a call about newborn twin girls that would be ours. We brought them home from the hospital at 6 days old. We named them, and I experienced a love that can't properly be explained. Unbeknownst to us, their biological father decided he wanted them, and 5 weeks later, the babies I thought were my daughters were taken back. I wasn't sure how to think or feel, and I truly didn't know if I had it in me to try again for adoption. I knew I was letting my fear control me, that the worry about giving my heart away again only to have it stomped on kept me from taking a next step. In the midst of such heartache, it's hard not to worry. I cried so many tears, thinking, Lord, why would you put this desire on my heart if it wasn't ever going to come true? And God, if we try again, you're not actually sending my heart out to be slaughtered, right? Because this process with court dates and bio parents and doctor's visits and trauma and the Department of Children and Family Services, that was already hard enough. You're not going to eviscerate us at the end of this, right? Right? Amid these fearful thoughts, I heard him ask me, do you have faith in my plan or not? That is what it boils down to. Faith. The belief that your life will unfold as it was meant to, even when it unfolds into something painful and difficult to navigate. Do I believe he has a plan? Absolutely. I've seen the proof of it too many times to consider anything else. That means I have to hold on to that belief even when the process isn't simple or easy or safe. I could make a list for you all day. I could point out 100 different moments in my life when I thought I should have something and was so upset about not getting it, only to discover in retrospect that it was never meant to be mine. Looking back, I think that was the case with my daughter. The other girls were only meant to be ours for a little while. And for whatever reason, we were only meant to be theirs for a short time. We were part of each other's journey, a stop along the way to the ultimate destination, even if we won't be there to see each other reach it. As I sit editing this chapter, my daughter is asleep in a bouncy seat on the kitchen table next to my computer. Just 5 months after the twins left, 5 months after I could not imagine trying to adopt again, we were matched with her first mom, through independent adoption. That season was filled with anxiety. I was so terrified of the things that could go wrong, that had gone wrong in the past, that I could hardly function. But what came out of the experience was a relationship with both Noah and her first family that is so special it could only have been crafted by the divine. And yet again, I am reminded that God has perfect timing. If you have a goal, that's fantastic. I'm one of the most motivated people you will ever meet. And my list of life goals is 9 miles long. But I've learned that along with my list of goals, I have to give myself some grace. Being married by 25, pregnant at 30, and the president of my division before I turned 40 are just arbitrary numbers. Because guess what? None of those preconceived notions or plans for myself worked out. Marriage and babies came way earlier than I thought, and career success came way later. Turns out, the most beautiful things in my life were never on my to-do list. Today, there may be items on your to-do list, but you also have a long list of things you have achieved. You've already done little things and big things, goals you accomplished years ago that are on someone else's bucket list. Focus on what you have done. Pay attention to the tiny steps you took across the living room carpet on wobbly legs. Celebrate the small moments. They're sacred, even if they aren't stepping stones to something else. Nothing is more important than today. God has perfect timing, and it's highly possible that by not being where you thought you should be, you will end up exactly where you're meant to go. Things that helped me. Number one, making a list. Seriously, list out everything you've accomplished to date. In fact, write yourself a letter about your tenacity. I took a workshop with Elizabeth Gilbert last year, and she asked us to do this, to speak from the part of ourselves that has achieved so much, that refused to back down. You want to see a room full of people sobbing? Ask them to do this task. When you force yourself to admit to all the things you have accomplished, you'll realize that it's wrong to be so hard on yourself for all the things you haven't. Number two, talking to someone. Many times we don't admit to the way we're feeling because we're too embarrassed. But when you have someone you can talk to who will listen to you say, "I feel worthless because I'm not a rock star by now," then you can experience the balm of their validation. "Are you kidding me right now?" they'll say. "Look at all the rad things you've done. You are amazing. Stop being so hard on yourself." Remember, when you keep silent, you give those lies power. Number three, setting goals, not time limits. I love goals. They can help you become your best self. But big dreams shouldn't have expiration dates. As long as you're working toward the things you hope to accomplish, it shouldn't matter if it takes you a month or a decade.